What do these celebrities have in common? Orson Welles, Marlon Brando, Groucho Marx, Charlie Chaplin, Marlena Dietrich, Barbara Streisand, Ingrid Bergman, Cary Grant, Gary Cooper, Clint Eastwood, Warren Beatty, Elizabeth Taylor, William Holden, Judy Garland, Gene Hackman, Frank Sinatra, Audrey Hepburn, Mickey Rooney, Bob Hope, Jay Leno, Johnny Carson, Paul Newman, Jack Nicholson, Kirk Douglas, Mike Douglas, Jack Lemmon, Hitchcock, and Schwarzenegger. They all have crossed paths with Dick Gutman. Dick is a Hollywood publicist, a Hollywood press agent, a job he has done for 6 decades, and a life that he writes about, and many of those people whose paths he has crossed, he writes about in a terrific new book called Star Flacker, Inside the Golden Age of Hollywood. And he joins me now. Hello, Dick. How are you?
Paul, I'm so happy to be back in St. Louis.
You're originally from here, right?
Was born and raised there.
Well, we're glad to have you back here, and I really enjoyed reading this book and getting some of the stories in there. And you start the book off with having to deal with a rumor about the death of Michael Caine. And I say that knowing that people who hear it will think, Michael Caine is dead? And I just want to assure you, Michael Caine is still alive as we do this show here today. But you got that phone call in the middle of the night a long time ago, and you knew instantly it could not be true. Why?
Well, I mean, it's always horrible when the AP calls you at 4 o'clock in the morning and even suggests that a friend and a client is gone. But so he was asking to confirm it. And I said, well, let me ask you a question. Were there any other injuries or deaths in the accident? He said, no, single passenger accident. I said, I can tell you right now that he wasn't killed in that car. He said, how do you know? And I said, he doesn't know how to drive.
That's an easy one for you.
Well, I went right back to sleep. Some of them, believe me, you don't go back to sleep.
But there had to be many, many times when you were awakened in the middle of the night by a phone call, and you just put your palm to your forehead and went, oh, okay, I guess I got to get up and deal with this.
Let me tell you, there was one. I love my wife ever more for this reason. A Sunday morning, I'm out by the pool cleaning leaves out of the pool. Phone rings. Official voice is Richard Governor. Richard Governor's always bad because that's not who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "Why? What is this about?" He says, "They wanted me to come up and identify the bodies on the Sharon Tate."
Mm.
And she looks out of the pool and she says, "He's gone. I don't know if I can reach him."
Mm-hmm.
And she gave him someone else to go up and do it. I would have lived with that the rest of my life.
Right, and those are images you can never unsee.
No.
Yeah. You started in this business at a time when media outlets played along with the public image of stars, right?
They helped create it. I mean, stardom was an important part of the American, not as it is now, but much less. It was an important part of the American, of the rhythm of America. You know, we had Cary Grant and Gary Cooper, and they each meant something. Each one of those stars meant something of what it meant to be an American. And not that they were always exactly the people that they were portraying, but the public adopted an image of them. And it carried us through wars, and it carried us through depressions, and it maintain the optimism of, and the sense of that we can deal with things. It was very, very, very important. And we don't have that now.
Did that involve a lot of lying on your client's behalf?
Sometimes, but I always say all of the lies were true. What it was is we needed to protect the people, but we had to protect the images. And so sometimes, you know, newspapers want to entertain their public, and good press agents, like good writers of any narrative writers, know how to do stories that are entertaining. So we would come up with things that help them fill their papers, and basically they were telling the truth. I mean, you're telling a story about Paul Newman. Basically what you're saying is Paul Newman is the guy, you know, for maybe forever, that Paul was the guy that represented stardom to us. And it was okay to put out the stuff that perpetuated that image of him.
So you would call a reporter at a newspaper, or probably in those days at a wire service, and say, look, I've got this story about Paul Newman. Do you want it? And because he was such a big name, they go, whatever it is, I want it.
They usually would, but what we did was, I mean, you control the image more by what you don't put out than by what you do put out. And I mean, I have one client, Barbara Streisand, who, if there's anything that's untrue, she's going to be very unhappy. That's, she's just predicated on that. And in fact, I don't. It changed. It really changed with social media. That's not in the old days. We used to give out stories, and the media would have to check, verify it or reject it. Now the media is putting out stories, and we have to shoot them down with. They're not true.
Are Facebook and Twitter and TMZ making it harder to be a press agent?
It's making it easier, but it's making it harder to do it in a dignified and a controlled manner. We represent Janet Jackson, and Rona Menashe of my office did her campaign last year, the tour and the album, and they're all sensational. And she didn't do one interview. And what Rona did was she'd work it out with Janet and her management that Janet at a certain time would put out a Twitter that would move the news. And then we would alert the media in a way that we selected. Maybe would give a tip to it to a billboard or whatever it was that would move the story in the most productive manner. The person who actually taught me that was Elizabeth Taylor, because we handled her for a very long time. And the last decade or so, the media were, you know, sitting a death watch. It was just terrible. One time, it was the rumors were so bad, and it wasn't helpful because she was, you know, Elizabeth ran, was the most important force in the dealing with HIV/AIDS, and people to think that she was, you know, in a coma or something like that, it hurt that. It also hurt her. She's one of the most successful perfumiers. Her perfume line was incredible. And so we were constantly dealing with, well, first of all, we don't answer the tabloids. The tabloids are going to be stories they're going to put out. I think people read the tabloids to be amused but not informed. And if I were to even to put a kibosh on a story, they would only use that to prove that they actually spoke to somebody who was associated with her. So there are these stories were coming out that she was in England. She was in England actually studying flowers at some of the great gardens because she would be making, perfume has what they call notes, the different aspects of a perfume. And she was gathering these floral notes for the next one. But there was a story saying she's there looking for her, where she's going to put her gravestone, wherever. And so finally, I suggested that we do a live interview. So I called Larry King. I said, Larry, I'd like you to do Liz. Oh, hey, we'll make it easy. We'll come to her house. We can cut things out. I said, I don't want you to come to her house. I want her to go to the station, have her be on live. She's the most vital person you know, and she's going to blow people away for an hour, and that'll put us to bed, and which we did. And the media, oh, it was like the Academy Awards, the media that was waiting outside, although I was pretty sure she wasn't going to do any interviews. And the next day, and she was great, the next day I get a call from a news producer at CNN saying, where are you going to be this weekend? I said, you mean in case Elizabeth Taylor dies? He said, well, yes. I said, are you aware that last night she was on Larry King on your station, and she couldn't have been more vital if she was, you know, part of the Cirque du Soleil. And she said, well, but we just have to ask.
We have to ask. We have to have the death watch, even though she doesn't seem to be dying.
Yeah.
We still have to be there. When you started in this, I'm sure you were not hired by individuals. You were hired by the studios to watch over the individuals who were under contract to those studios, right?
Actually, I came in around 1954. I was just looking for an office boy. I was looking for a job. And there's a thing, office by this company called Rogers & Cowan. I go there. I have a car. They have deliveries. That's fine. I can work 1 o'clock on. And so I'm delivering the memos inside the office, but I'm not reading them. And I go to one door that I'm delivering something, and Kirk Douglas answers the door, and I think, wait, what are these guys doing over there? And I had been a journalist all my life, but I grew up in St. Louis, and my my grandmother was a Pulitzer, and so of course I was going to be a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started reading these memos, and I saw, well, these are people that put things in the paper for Stars, and I suddenly realized I've been training to do this all my life. And the great thing was, I'm working for the biggest company there's ever been in public relations. They handled more Stars than MGM had. They had maybe the biggest congregation of Stars of any entity of all time. And so immediately I'm working with all of the great Stars of the time. And I found out they're pretty good people and you don't have to be afraid of them. And once you know that, it works pretty easy.
Mm-hmm. When did it go from having to work for the parent companies, as it were, to being hired by the individuals? Did Barbara Streisand, did Elizabeth Taylor, did later Jay Leno, did they all hire you individually?
Well, that had to do with the time, because the 50s is when it stopped being the studio contract system. Up until then, all the Stars were basically owned by, you know, Jimmy Cagney and Bette Davis by Warner Brothers, Greer Garson and Lana Turner and Clark Gable by MGM. And that was coming to an end, and everybody was very excited about it. We didn't know that was a very sad time, because those dictatorial studio bosses had one thing in common. They wanted to make great movies. They loved making movies, and they jealously wanted to make important films that, you know, affected your life and made you laugh and made you cry and helped you. And they did. I mean, the movies were important. And suddenly, they're not there so much anymore, and the Stars now are really starting to have to scramble to be able to help bring money in to make a film happen. So it became pretty hysterical, because we weren't working for the studios anymore. And the studios resented that, and then pretty soon they realized that they needed us. And so what the Stars got in return for paying us was they could control their own image.
I mentioned a minute ago the name Jay Leno. You worked with him for a long time. In fact, you were part of his team when he was forced out of The Tonight Show in favor of Conan O'Brien, and then brought back when Conan's Tonight Show wasn't all that successful. And you write in the book about Jay's modesty about his success, which limited what you were allowed to do as a publicist, didn't it?
Well, in a way, more his humility than his... He never wanted to be... I tell you, if we're live, people should turn on CNBC tonight at 7 o'clock,
yep,
our time, I suppose, whatever time Jay Leno's garage is on. There's a lot of press, because on the show tonight, he has a big crash.
Yep.
He's in doing this car stunt, and the car rolls about 6 times. And you're in the car with him, and you could see he doesn't know if he's coming out of this in one piece. It's quite a... But that's Jay. He loves things that are fast. He loves things that are loud. And he comes out of it, and he says, "That's about as exciting as you can get." You know, everybody else would be calling for 911.
Right. You tell a story in the book about when the Writers Guild, he got involved in a kind of a dust-up with the Writers Guild, and I think that was right about the time of the writers' strike a few years ago, right?
Yeah, there was the strike. Well, the way it related to Jay was, Jay took care of his family. You know, his team that made the show with him was his family. And so when the strike first came and his writers couldn't do it, they went off the air for about a month. And Jay paid his staff. Well, it cost him $1.5 million. And he wanted to keep paying, but even Jay Leno can't afford it in perpetuity. So the Writers Guild law says that you can do your own material. If you're your own writer, you can do it. So he just started writing his own shows, and then he'd think, you know, the old jokes of a minister, a priest, and a rabbi going to a bar.
Yeah.
Well, he'd start bringing in, at the beginning of the show, a priest, a rabbi, and a minister, and they would each tell their own jokes. Well, he did all these great things, and the shows were as good as ever. And he was attacked by some of the Writers Guild members, saying that he was breaking the rules, which he wasn't. And then afterwards, it was determined the Writers Guild said, no, he was absolutely right, and we want to make a public apology. And Jay said, no apologies, it's fine. I mean, that's Jay. And then he'd go out on the picket line and give donuts to the guys.
Mm-hmm. But he insisted that they not apologize, and they insisted, we're going to apologize. Yeah.
You know, I think it sort of leaked out, but there was no official apology because it really made him. But that's who Jay is. And there was one time where he was going to, he was called as a witness for the Michael Jackson trial. And I saw the day before Larry King had been. And so Larry went with, you know, there were like five guys with him. And I said to Jay, you know, Larry went. I love Larry, but it looked like he was the accused. And so the guys are, I said, you go alone. And I said, no darn press agents. He says, okay, no darn press agents. And so it was interesting. I was driving to the office to see it. There was a traffic jam, as there always is. And I'm listening to the radio, and they're watching the TV, and they say, and here comes Jay Leno. Oh, my gosh, there's nobody with him. What a guy.
Because he didn't have all of his press agents surrounding him a la Larry King.
He doesn't need it.
Yeah.
He doesn't need it. You know, who's going to write it? A funny line for Jay Leno.
Before I let you go here, Dick, I'm curious about being a press agent when you have to deal with paparazzi. You actually testified before Congress about putting limits on paparazzi, didn't you?
I testified that, yes, it was a bill coming up that the Screen Actors Guild asked me to do it. And the bill was coming up that would define how privacy was violated. I have to say, paparazzis, you have to understand, are the guys that hide in bushes and try to get bad shots or to provoke you into something. The people that are at the premieres and everything, those are good guys. Those are event photographers. And you know, what would Hollywood be without them, without the flashing lights?
Right.
But I did go, and I was very concerned because there were new electronic ways that people were being, their privacy was being hit. And so I wanted to bring up a Supreme Court case that happened, but it pertained to the Fourth Amendment, which is really due process. But I said, but look, the Supreme Court, this may have pertained to due process, not privacy, but they did define electronic enhancements as invasions. And I don't know if the bill passed. I think eventually it may have. But that was pretty exciting. I mean, I was never so nervous in my life.
Were there paparazzi taking pictures of you going into Congress, Dick?
No, there were some photographers. I mean, they were there because Paul Reiser and Michael J. Fox were appearing too.
And as a press agent, did you say, over here, I got Michael J. Fox and Paul Reiser?
Well, it worked because when we were flying back to L.A., Paul Reiser and his manager were able to help move me up from steerage to the first class. So that was a good thing. But it was very exciting, and I said to my wife, I think I'm going to call Marty Landau and ask how I should. Marty's, you know, one of the greatest actors of all time and the greatest teacher. And I said, I should call him. She said, you won't understand. His knowledge is so refined, you won't relate to it. Mm. So I didn't. So I told it to Marty. He said, what did you do? I said, well, I read it, but I had a couple of times I really wanted to look him in the eye, and I memorized those three or four passages. He says, that's what I would have told you to do.
The book is full of all sorts of great stories about all these stars. I mean, Jacqueline Bisset and Jane Seymour and Sean Connery and Natalie Wood and Christopher Reeve, and you mentioned Paul Newman, James Mason. There are some Clint Eastwood stories in here that are wonderful. The book is called Star Flacker, Inside the Golden Age of Hollywood, and here's a guy who's been part of it for six decades or more. His name is Dick Gutman. Thank you so much for joining me here today, and good luck with the book.
Thanks for inviting me back to St. Louis. St. Louis made me what I am.
It's a pleasure. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.